Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. If you've been listening to The Spot over the past year, you've definitely heard about the Memory Palace.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo.
That's the one. The podcast brings an inquisitive and uniquely poetic perspective on overlooked nooks and crannies of history. The Memory Palace is like a photograph of a bygone time coming to life in audio alone, or like being read a bedtime story that's also teaching you something you never knew before about the human experience. On today's show, I'll be speaking with creator and host of The Memory Palace, Nate DeMeo, about how he became inspired back in 2008 to launch the podcast and also where he finds the inspiration for the stories he tells. But first, I'd like to start with one of my favorite, shorter episodes of The Memory Palace. The title of this one is Distance.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. Samuel Finley Breese Morse spent the first 35 years of his life learning to paint at Andover, at Yale, in London at the Royal Academy. He studied the works of the masters to learn how Michelangelo built bodies that seemed to pulse and shudder out of mere oil and shadow and crosshatch. To learn how Raphael summoned the spark of inner life with a single stroke of pure white in the dusky ochre of a noblewoman's eye. To learn how to create illusions of space and distance. To learn how to conjure the ineffable through the mere aggregation of lines and dots and stretched canvas. He learned how to paint. And in 1825, Morse was living in New Haven, Connecticut with his wife Lucretia and two young sons. And a third child was on the way, due any day. One night, a courier delivered a message. The city of New York wanted to pay Morse $1,000 to paint a portrait of the Marquis de Lafayette. The hero of the Revolution was coming to Washington to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the start of the war, and he would sit for Morse if the painter could leave right away. So he packed his easel and his brushes and his paints in clothes that were good enough to wear when meeting a man like Lafayette. And he kissed his pregnant wife, and he left that night. On another night, a week later, Morse was in his rented studio in Washington, preparing for the arrival the next morning of his distinguished subject. He heard a knock on the door, and there was a courier, breathless and dirty from a hard ride on hard road, handing him a note that was five words long. "Your dear wife is convalescent." He left that night. He rode for 6 days straight, on horseback and in the backs of juddering wagons, wrapped in blankets against the cold wind of October nights. And when he made it to New Haven and ran through fallen leaves up to the house on Whitney Avenue, he learned that his wife was dead. In fact, she had died before the courier had knocked on his door in Washington. In fact, she had already been buried some morning while he was on the road, while he was racing home to be by her side and sit with her while she got better. Samuel Finley Breese Morse spent the next 45 years of his life trying to make sure no one would have to feel the way he felt that night, ever again. Samuel Finley Breese Morse spent the next 45 years inventing the telegraph to turn real space and real distance into illusion. In developing Morse code, dots and lines that could transmit the stuff of real lives and of dying wives.
That story always leaves me feeling a bit misty around the eyes. It's from the podcast The Memory Palace, produced by my special guest, Nate DeMeo, who I spoke with earlier this month over the phone. Hi, Nate. Thanks so much for joining us on The Spot today.
So happy to be here.
So I'm really curious, what inspired you to begin The Memory Palace?
Thank you so much for listening at all. I, like you, was in radio for a long time. And I just had this real drive on some level to start something on my own. I grew up hearing sort of great stories from my parents about their parents and on and on. There was like this real sort of sense of kind of like time as a continuum and me being part of a chain. And what I noticed as I sort of grew with that was that, like, the past was cool and memory was cool. But what made it cool on some level was stories. So as I end up starting the Memory Palace, in a sense, but sort of like, you know what, there isn't a history show. Maybe there ought to be a history show. And I do like history enough to do that. But what I really thought I might be able to do was kind of crack the problem of telling history stories on the radio. And that's sort of the podcast started out as an effort to sort of an experiment to see if I could do that.
So starting out, was it clear at the very beginning when you're like, okay, I know I want to be working on my own project. I feel really strongly towards leaning towards stories that are historical and kind of exploring histories. Were there stories that just sort of jumped out at you, like story ideas that made you think like, oh, this is actually what I should be doing right now?
Until essentially now, the Memory Palace has come out very sporadically, you know, and it's in a lot of ways for a number of years, it kind of had the presence of like an art project, an ongoing art project in my life. But so because of that, for a number of years, like the stories in the Memory Palace that make up those initial episodes were on some level just like things that had stayed with me for years and years and years that hadn't quite found a place for, you know, these were stories that I had, you know, experiences I had had like in weird historic home tours. That these were little moments that popped out of gigantic documentaries where I was like, whoa, who cares about the other like 15 hours? Like this weird, like 30 second hit in the middle of episode 3 of this Ken Burns documentary. Like this is where this thing lives. You know, like on some level, these were, you know, cocktail party anecdotes or, you know, like things that were like, hey, I got a cool fact for you. But more than that, there were just kind of things that had at one point moved me, you know, like these were things that had jumped out of, you know, of a page in some, you know, some longer book or had jumped out, you know, from some story that someone else had told me and really kind of grabbed me and said, like, you know, this is like, you know, like this is incredible and this is sort of wonderful in the literal full of wonder sort of sense of the word, you know, the death of the passenger pigeon in North America.
It was said that if you shot a rifle into the air as they flew overhead, that one shot could take down 30 birds. They were flying so close that they'd collide, like some sort of horrible pileup on an interstate.
You know, or this guy in a town near me who became very famous in the early 19th century for jumping off of really tall things. Like these things at one point, like really, you know, made my day learning those things.
So beginning this week, subscribers of the Memory Palace will be receiving new episodes every week for the rest of the summer. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah. It's going to start to be a seasonal enterprise, you know, for a number of reasons, some of them sort of like calculated and some of them just sort of like, how am I actually going to get this work done when it has been at times so difficult to get a single episode done? I've decided to release it in season. So there'll be a summer season, which was fairly arbitrary, but I kind of like the romance of it. Then there'll be some other season, maybe in late fall with like, maybe like some sort of like little mini 3-episode serialized story in the middle or something like that. I don't quite know precisely what happens beyond the summer, but yes, starting on June 21st, every Monday through the summer until Labor Day, there will be, a new episode, which is a totally new thing for me and a new thing for listeners.
So for any listeners who are tuned in right now to The Spot who aren't subscribers of the Memory Palace yet, how would you recommend they become a subscriber? Where should they go?
They should go to iTunes. They should go to my website, which is thememorypalace.us. Or if it's easy to remember, thememorypalace.org, both work and are the same. But yeah, wherever you listen to podcasts, which is the beauty of podcasts.
Thanks so much again for joining us today, Nate.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Since I spoke with Nate, he has a big announcement that he'd like me to share with the listeners of The Spot. The Memory Palace will soon join Radiotopia.
Radiotopia.
The network of podcasts that features 99% Invisible, The Kitchen Sisters' Fugitive Waves, The Heart, and many more audio gems. Radiotopia has also added a few more shows to its ranks since the last time I mentioned it on The Spot. So check it all out on their website, radiotopia.fm. Before we exit the Memory Palace today, I had one more story from the show that I wanted to feature. A meditation on an athlete that was once larger than life. It's a story that's both heartbreaking and a little bit hilarious, as the Memory Palace often is.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. The rings were rectangular and smaller then. And John L. Sullivan could remember how the ropes felt against his bare back, how his hands felt in gloves for the first time. He could remember how his knuckles felt when they'd slam into a man's jaw, get in under his ribs, crack the bridge of his nose like ice underfoot. And he could remember getting hit, and remember not caring. Not during that night in 1878. It wasn't his first fight for sure. He didn't make it to 21 as an Irish kid in South Boston back then, if he didn't know how to throw a punch. But that night was the first time he got paid for it, in a tiny ring on a tiny stage, in between the comedians and the chorus girls and the magicians at a music hall in Roxbury. He could remember the man he fought, vaguely, Mike something. Could remember hitting him. Could remember how it felt. How it felt good. Remember connecting with a big right to the jaw that knocked the big man out and sent him through the ropes and over the edge of the stage and into the orchestra pit and on to the cowering cellists and violinists below. Could remember turning to face the crowd, sweating, surely bleeding, and hearing it roar. At least he thought he could remember. It was a long time ago, and there had been so many fights and so much life between then and now, between Boston and St. Louis. It was the summer of 1904, and the greatest athletes in the world had descended upon the American Middle West for the Olympics. And the most famous athlete of all sat on a bar stool in a saloon on Market Street, talking per his contract to anyone who bought a drink, all day, all night. And the crowds came, lined out through the door, glad to see the famous man they had been reading about in the papers for years. The man some of them grew up wanting to be. The man they loved from afar. And whom they were now getting a chance to see up close. Celebrities are always so much smaller than you think they'll be. And Sullivan was too. Even though he'd gotten so much larger lately. He wasn't the 195-pound panther who knocked out Patty Ryan in Mississippi. Or knocked John Flood, the bullhead terrier, down 8 times in 8 rounds on a barge in the middle of the Hudson, floating free of New York's anti-boxing laws. He didn't look like the man who beat Jake Kilrain in 1889, bare-knuckled, in 108-degree heat in front of 3,000 people who were sure Sullivan was done for when he threw up right there in the ring in the 44th round, but then kept fighting until Kilrain quit after the 75th. That wasn't quite the same man who teetered on the stool at the end of the bar. 100 pounds heavier. His breath labored and rank. His face misshapen, puffed and pale from too many beers and too many shots of whiskey, too many shots to the head. He could still remember the stories, could trip over the details in the fog, and give his fans their money's worth. Telling of punches he'd thrown that landed like pianos plummeting to the sidewalk, like felled redwoods, like meteors. And the punches he took, the ones that knocked him down but not out, because John L. Sullivan, at least the John L. Sullivan he still was in his own mind, was not a man you knocked out. He was a man who got up. Even if he needed a little help now getting off the bar stool to pee. He told the drinkers of his coast-to-coast tour when he fought 195 times in 135 towns in 235 days, taking on anyone who stood up to challenge him, and taking home a king's ransom along the way. He told them of meeting the kings of Europe, and of his personal friend Teddy Roosevelt, of fighting to a 39-round draw, no gloves, 3 hours, all in the rain, at a French chateau, and of the women and of the parties. And so people kept coming in to the saloon, and they'd sit for a while and drink their drink and hear a story. They probably didn't hear much about the one time he did get knocked down, by the younger, faster, fitter Jim Corbett, and how he came to on his back, looking up at the fuzzy halos of electric lights strung over the ring, long after the referee reached 10, and how he swore he'd come back, but hadn't yet, and how his drinking got worse, and sometimes he couldn't make it up on stage in his second career as an actor, how he'd forget his lines, how he'd wind up in the drunk tank, or wind up throwing someone through a plate glass window. He didn't tell them how all the stories kind of folded together and got harder to remember. He probably didn't talk about that with the people buying him drinks. But they probably noticed anyway. Maybe that's what they talked about on their way home, or told their friends the next day at work. Because his stories didn't matter. Not to them. They had their story. The time they met John L. Sullivan, the Boston Strong Boy. And Sullivan's time wore on, and he was still on the bar stool at the saloon in Market Street in St. Louis, getting sloppy and surly, sleeping with his head on the bar in the middle of the day. Days after, the last of the crowds came in to hear one more story, and the bartender told him to get up and get going. And John L. Sullivan got up, because he was a man who gets up. He resolved that day never to drink again. He resolved to get back into fighting shape. He resolved to live clean from that day forward. And he didn't. He was an alcoholic. And he couldn't just burn that off with a jump rope and a medicine ball. And it destroyed his liver and made a mess of his insides. And the fights took care of the rest. And he died at 59 years old, which is young, but really. But let's go back to the bar stool. Where do we put our heroes when their capacity for heroism disappears? When their knees go? When their bat speed or their hops or their vertical or their velocity finally fails them? Finally fails us. There are halls of fame. There are highlight reels. Old-timers' days. There are cable networks with 24 hours to fill. And there are bar stools in St. Louis. There are casino lobbies in Atlantic City. There are folding tables set up at card shows in the multi-purpose rooms of Holiday Inn Expresses off the interstate. And then there's John L. Sullivan. The rap on Sullivan, the capper to the blurbs in the boxing books, the kicker to his Wikipedia entry, is that boxing's first great champion, the first athlete to earn $1 million, died with 10 bucks to his name. And that's true, more or less. But between the bar stool and his death 14 years later, there was a lot of life left in him. He'd fall off the wagon. He'd climb back on. He'd mount a comeback. And he'd come back down. He was a sports writer. He was a farmer. He lectured on temperance and manly virtue. He'd start a business and it would fail. And he'd start another and it would fail. He was a widower. He was a hail fellow, well met. He was a man who got up.
That story was produced by Nate DeMayo. You can find more from his podcast, The Memory Palace, at thememorypalace.us. You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. And now, a very different story about a very different boxer. One that takes place right in KALW's backyard in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood. It's been going through a lot of changes recently. Redevelopment at the shipyard, new housing projects going up, and new businesses moving in. Still, it can be a rough neighborhood to grow up in, but sometimes being in a tough place just makes you tougher. Here's the story of one local boxer who is fighting her way to the top.
At first glance, Raquel Miller has more than a few things in common with a Hollywood heiress. She wears her hair in long, soft curls or braids, carries a bedazzled Hello Kitty iPhone case that matches her neon pink Nikes, and she always has her miniature dog in tow. Not exactly the stuff to scare you away, but if you knew Raquel in high school, you might have thought twice about bumping into her.
I didn't do that well with around a lot of my peers, and some of it was because of fighting.
Raquel is mostly getting into street fights, schoolyard brawls, and as she got older, her friends didn't miss a chance to remind her of all the times she started trouble.
Yeah, remember you did this? And I was like, be quiet, like shut up, like don't say that. I'd be embarrassed.
All this teasing eventually made her think.
I don't want to be known as this girl. I didn't want to be known like that. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to box because I wanted to be known for something better. It was a point to prove to myself that I was better than a street fighter.
At first, Raquel figured becoming a boxer would be easy. She found a coach and told them she was ready to jump in the ring. But it turned out, becoming a boxer would take a lot of work. Work like running, weightlifting, and most of all, discipline.
I didn't want to train. I knew how to street fight, and I figured that that translated into boxing. And the coach said no. Sparring was a privilege, and if I wasn't willing to put in the work, I wasn't going to spar. So I said I quit.
Over the next couple years, Raquel couldn't quite shake the feeling that she'd given up too quickly. So she tried again. This time she worked out daily, changed her diet, and even found a new coach. But after a while, she realized he wasn't really on her side.
He didn't believe the women deserved to be in the ring, and he told me that I should be a ring card girl.
You know, the women in hot pants that hold up cards announcing each round of a boxing tournament.
It took something out of me. I was like, you know what? Guys don't believe in women boxing, and usually the best coaches are males for the most part, and so I was discouraged.
Raquel thought this time she was quitting for good. But a few months later, something made her reconsider. It happened when she was traveling in Brazil with a friend.
And she just said to me, you know, what's one thing that you've always wanted to do that you've never done? And I said, I always wanted to be a boxer. So we made a promise to each other, this time, no matter what, I'm not stopping.
And for the rest of the trip, Raquel's friend wouldn't let her forget that promise. She bragged to all the locals.
She's going to be a famous boxer. She's going to the Olympics.
With less than 2 years before the Olympic Games in London, the first to ever include women's boxing, she promised her friend and herself that she would earn a spot on Team USA. And that meant spending all her coming days in the ring.
So, sir, how you feeling?
Good.
Ready to put this work in?
Yeah, let's work.
That's Jairo Escobar, one of Raquel's current trainers. They grew up a couple blocks away from each other in the Bayview. Now they meet several nights a week at World's Gym on 16th and Mission to practice sparring and study techniques.
Hey, did you see those videos I was talking about?
I did.
What'd you think about it? You kind of see what I'm talking about?
I definitely saw the Pacquiao video, exactly what he was doing.
This time around, Raquel committed her life to boxing. And according to Jairo, what she lacked in experience, she quickly made up for it in work ethic and instinct.
Every day she gets better. She's just getting better and better.
No one's had a better view of Raquel's transformation than her sister, Tanisha. She often stops by to watch Raquel train.
Who's cooking dinner tonight? You. No, you missed. How many did she miss? 5 times?
When Raquel started training again, her car was broken down, and Tanisha was her daily ride.
And I would come and stay in the car and fall asleep or whatever I had to do just to be there to give her a ride back home when she was done with practicing.
When no one believed, she was the one that said, just keep going. Like, I believe. They don't have to believe. I believe.
In less than 2 years, she started winning national tournaments and qualified for the World Championships in Beijing, a precursor to the Olympics in London.
Well, Miller in the red corner. Not even boxing 2 years. Congratulations to Raquel Miller of San Francisco, USA.
Raquel, she won a silver medal in China and was selected to go to the Olympic Games in London as part of the first U.S. women's boxing team. But this time, it would only be as an alternate.
I prayed endlessly to go to London. And I would talk to God and I would say, God, you know, just let me go to London. God, I want to go to London. I want to go to London. And I was like, God gave me my wish. I kept saying, God, I want to go to London. I should have said, God, I want to go compete in London and be an Olympian, not just here. So I got what I wished for. So this time when I pray, I say, God, I want to go compete in Rio. God, I want to win a gold medal.
To make it to Rio in 2016, Raquel is training multiple times a day, starting with a morning run.
So, what are you listening to today?
I have a mixture.
Raquel used to hit the treadmill. Now she prefers running in her own neighborhood.
I would run by all these streets I've grown up on. All these streets where I have all these memories, and people from the community would start honking at me and, you know, throwing me peace signs and, you know, pump it up.
Many of the people cheering her on were the same classmates she'd been in fights with. They told her that seeing her train inspired them to pursue their own goals.
I just realized that me boxing, it mended the broken bridges that I've broken as we grew up, when we were fighting over stupid things and didn't really understand. And when these kids see me running up and down these streets early in the morning and people see me shadow boxing, they're gonna know that I come from where you come from. I'm just like you, I'm no different. We can do anything we set our mind to.
That story was reported by Mitzi Mock and originally aired in 2013 on Cross Currents as a part of their Sights and Sounds of Bayview series. This Friday, KALW is hosting a special live event presenting the latest round of stories from the series, all from San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood. And you are invited. Join us Friday, June 19th at the Joseph Lee Recreation Center in San Francisco. The event kicks off at 5:45 with music and food, and the main event begins at 7 p.m. Full details can be found at the top of our homepage at kalw.org. Look for the Sights and Sounds of Bayview. I'll be there that night, so be sure to say hi to the short lady wearing the neon pink glasses. Cross Currents has a podcast that you can subscribe to in iTunes, and you can also find the stories from the Sights and Sounds of Bayview series on kalw.org. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. I'd like to give a special shout out to Nate DeMayo for sharing his storytelling secrets on the show today. You can find this episode of The Spot and more at kalw.org. Look on the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. We have a playlist on soundcloud.com too. Search for it under KALW. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.